Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. I'm the producer, Caleb Keith, and I'm joined by our hosts, Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco. Follow these great minds as they answer pressing questions about theology, history, and apologetics. This show is brought to you by 1517 The Legacy Project, serving to proclaim the gospel to all people, especially those broken by the church.
Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. I'm producer Caleb, and today I'm joined, as usual, by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Adam Francisco, and Keith. Today we're doing an extension of the episode that you would have heard last week, which was the reliability of the New Testament documents. And we're doing a part two just to kind of recap and finish up some of the important issues going on there. But before we jump in the show, I have a couple of exciting announcements for our listeners. Today, as a recording, is October 2nd. You're probably going to be listening to this a couple weeks after the fact. But for the month of September, we ended the show with just over 14,000 downloads, which is a big milestone for us. That means we gained over 2,000 downloads from the month before. So the Thinking Fellows is growing, which is a huge thank you to our fans who share it with their friends, share it on Facebook and Twitter, who email us around, who give us ratings on iTunes so that it gets a little more exposure there. And so we just wanted to really thank our fans for pushing us to that next level. We're continuing to grow. The projection for next month is again up. So big thank you. Along with that, I wanted to thank our donors who make the show possible. All of the equipment, all of the guests that we have, everything, the production of the show isn't possible without donations. And so we thank you for your continued support. And if you aren't a donor yet, we'd like you to please consider going to the Thinking Fellows website and hitting the donate button there. There's a small form that allows you to put in your debit or credit card information to donate, and any amount is worthwhile. You know, anything, $5, whatever you can afford, but it really helps keep the show going. It allows us to continue to have great guests like Dr. Jim Neskin and Robert Kolb, which were just fantastic episodes if you haven't listened to those yet. So if you like the show, you want good new content, keep coming, please consider donating. Besides that, you can find us on Facebook if you search Thinking Fellows Podcast, on Twitter at Thinking Fellows, and of course on our website, thinkingfellows.com, where you can find all of the show notes and links and books that we mention throughout each episode. So Dr. Keith, are you ready to hop on in?
I am.
All right, let's go.
Here we go. So continuing with the reliability of the New Testament documents, I was hoping that maybe Adam and Rod would be willing to give us a little bit of a recap, because for us it's been several weeks since we did that last recording. What we the foundational aspects to sort of our argument, the evidential argument, had to do with, in broken into three parts, three tests really, as we've called them: the bibliographical test, the internal test, and the external test. And these tests are what would be applied to any document in history or ancient history.
That's very important. We're not doing something theological here.
Right. No, this is actually a historical methodology that's being used here, and particularly one used with ancient historical documents, but historical documents just generally. But I was hoping maybe Adam or Rod, you could give us sort of a recap on what those are, the bibliographical test. What's going on there?
Well, there you're asking the question, do we have a Greek text of the New Testament that is substantially dependable? That is, you're asking the question of terrible corruption or no. And the answer is that the New Testament documents are in fabulous shape compared to comparable documents of antiquity. Here you're facing things like, what is the time period between the original author and our first text or manuscript? And in the classical work, sometimes it's over 1,000 years. And in the New Testament, we have such a rich history that we can show that it's certainly under 300 years, and every single year that goes by, this seems to push back earlier, not later.
Right.
We're going to tackle the higher critical method later on, but leaving that out for the claptrap that it is, and just staying with historical method, there are guys in the field who would sell their mothers into white slavery to have the riches that we've got in terms of how soon it was on the street.
Right. Right, and sometimes when I do this in class, I think I said it last time, I'll put up a picture, a literal picture of one of the manuscripts of the Gospel of John that we have, because it's I think, important for them to know that what we're talking about here is not how many translations of their NIV Bible are available, but how many of these manuscripts written in the original language,
right,
as old as we can get. And it the picture kind of gives them a visualization of what this is like. You know, they have holes in them and everything like that. And because one of the other things we deal with here is not just how close to the date are our manuscripts, but how many of them do we have?
Sure.
And then I'll sometimes talk to them about, okay, so this one, it's in this tattered kind of shape. What would be good? And they'll often say, well, you need, maybe if you had another one, you could compare it to. And we kind of go from there to how many would be good to compare. Well, the more, the better. And then you can get into actually how many of these manuscripts that we have.
Is, what you're describing is called lower or textual criticism. That is the establishment of what the original text was. And this is just bedrock important. It here you're talking about something that really can be described sort of as a science because of all the manuscripts and the ability to collate. Now, overall, it's important to remember, especially in a time when criticism is all over the place, it's important to remember that in the case of the Greek New Testament text, what we argue about is fewer than 5% of it, or less than 5% of it.
Right.
That's good to know right off the bat. In other words, theological liberals who would hate to acknowledge this and do have to, just on the basis of objective manuscripts, have to say something like, anybody who doubts the authorship of Romans or any part of Romans, we don't count. I mean, the textual evidence is so good for the Greek text. And that's important to know.
Yeah.
The textual tradition is so strong, especially as compared with anything from comparable age, that it's, with 96% of the text itself, it's hands down.
Yeah. It, very important for today, especially with books with titles like Misquoting Jesus, available at Costco. You know, I think if you go back, if you go to before 1990, this kind of higher critical approach to the Bible was pretty much contained within academia.
Yep.
Broadly considered.
Yep.
Then you get the movement, the Jesus Seminar comes around and starts popularizing that. And then you get today scholars like Bart Ehrman.
Sure.
Who will make seemingly true statements to the fact that, yeah, there's lots of manuscripts, but there's so many copyist errors that it's really not reliable. Well, those copyist errors, you should expect, especially if you've got 5,000, maybe more, actually quite a bit more, Greek New Testament manuscripts. Add to that the translations, and you got, you know, 25,000 manuscripts, and of course there's going to be copyist errors, and the copyist errors are pretty, it's minimal stuff.
Many times it's trivial. A difference in conjunctions, or one manuscript will say Jesus went, and the other will say he went.
Mm-hmm.
Much of it's trivial.
Yeah, 90, you said 96%. Mm-hmm. I've heard the figure as high as 99% is trivial. Who knows? It's somewhere between there.
99% is dependable.
Yes, yeah, yes. Yeah. But Ehrman will make claims, and others will quote him, you know, polemicists, you know, the new atheists on one side love Bart Ehrman, as do the Muslims on the other side.
Yep.
And they will quote Ehrman saying that there are more copyist errors in all the manuscripts than there are words in the New Testament.
Oh, God.
Which is a true statement, but these copyist errors aren't don't amount to anything for the most part. There are a couple exceptions.
Yep.
And it's just that you said 5% of the text that's argued over. And let's just say, hypothetically, you got rid of that 5%.
Yep.
Would it change anything?
Nope.
Not at all.
Nope. So that's the overall important umbrella. How much of the text are we talking about? Answer, very little.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, there are exceptions. For instance, everybody recognizes that there's an ending to Mark that's usually typeset differently in their Bible than the rest of it. Well, that's a hunk over which there's argument. Another one, interestingly enough, is Jesus saying to the lady caught in adultery, go and sin no more. The oldest don't have that. Mm. The one in John where the first one who gets to the pool of Siloam will be healed. That's not in the oldest manuscripts. But those are paragraphs, and there are not very many of those. Other than that, we're talking about what you mentioned earlier, Adam, conjunctions and prepositions and pronouns.
Yeah. And if you think of like lectionaries, you know, lists of readings for the day, right? Mm-hmm. And if the reading starts with a pronoun, of course they're going to put the proper noun in there, the proper name.
Sure.
But every time you get that, that counts as an error or a copyist error, right?
Yeah.
So the number adds up quickly. The substance of the errors are real minimal.
Yeah.
But they never, when Bart Ehrman says this or when people are quoting Bart Ehrman, they never go into, well, what are the nature of these errors? They just make the statement there are just thousands upon thousands of errors. And so if we got these mistakes by scribes, what else crept in or what else was taken out?
Sure.
They get into the realm of speculation. And there's no evidence that large portions were taken out or huge portions were added. Doctrines were added. Or
properly corresponding pronouns are errors. Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it in the context where you have, especially like in a fundamentalist culture,
right,
where you have this view of the text that's more akin to, you know, in a sense, the Muslim view of the Quran that has been perfectly preserved for centuries.
Right, yeah.
Christians have never really taught that.
Nope.
They've taught inerrancy, but they don't mean that.
Yep.
But if that's the assumption by the laity, the common person, that inerrancy means that the Holy Spirit guided every scribe through the ages as they're copying this text down, then it's really shocking.
Yep.
And so, you know, pastors in Bible study or just Christians studying really do need to be aware of what we mean when we use terms like inerrancy. So when the facts are laid before us, we know how to make sense of that.
Yeah, I think in my day, the scholar was now the late Bruce Metzger at Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
There may have been others who have since taken his place, but Metzger was sort of, and he was PCUSA, that's yuck, but Metzger was the text guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He wasn't alone, there's a long history of this, but in our day, it was Bruce Metzger. That's his books are titled thrillingly something like "The Text of the New Testament."
Yeah, sexy titles.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go on quickly. Just for recap, internal evidence. What are we looking at when we say internal evidence or internal test?
If I remember correctly, this has to do with the claims of the documents themselves. And whether there's inner corroboration one from the other. And you find over and over and over again references in the New Testament by people who say things like, we witnessed this ourselves, or we have seen him concerning the word of life, or we were there on the mountain when, over and over and over again. And this is important.
Mm-hmm.
You can't overlook this. They claim to have been there and witnessed these things.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can't overlook that.
Yeah. The four Gospels, the earliest manuscripts do not contain the Gospel according to Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. So the internal test deals with a lot of things, but especially for establishing the reliability of the texts, are they written by people? Is there enough internal evidence to suggest these are written by eyewitnesses
right.
or people who are in a community that includes eyewitnesses that they could have checked against or gotten information or material from?
Right. And very important to know that in the earliest days, these things individually hit the streets. And they hit the streets during a time when there were living people who had been in the Passover in Jerusalem during that week. And it was a wonderful invitation to overthrow the message because there were people who were there.
Right. This is John. This is like the John's type of language, the I saw, I touched, I heard, establishing that this isn't some sort of person from the fourth century writing what he thinks about something he maybe heard.
Right.
But this is somebody who was there at the time witnessing the events or at least interviewing an eyewitness of the event.
Right.
Like
Luke
Adam said, in the community. Of eyewitnesses, and just verifying and establishing that they have the authority to write the document that's in front of you.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah, this is important today because, again, this liberal, higher critical scholarship has become popularized. And so there are folks out there who will claim that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are good sources, to be sure, but there are other ancient gospels, you know, the non-canonical and gospel or Gnostic gospels. That all have titles like the Gospel According to Thomas or the Gospel According to Peter. And so why would you prefer four Gospels that the church later on recognized were written by Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John? Why would you prefer those over ones that actually have the title? Well, if you look at the internal testimony, think of the Gospel of Peter, probably written 3rd century. So it's way too late to have been written by Peter.
Sure.
And the internal content doesn't even read like something that place in time and space. A cross comes, like a pogo stick, comes out of the tomb on Easter morning and it all of a sudden extends into the heavens and proclaims the resurrection. There is no like real historical narrative to it.
Yeah, so. You find things. The one that was the classic one back when I was in seminary was, I think, from the Gospel of Thomas, where when Jesus was a boy, he made some birds out of sand, told them to fly away, and they did. There's a qualitative difference between those later pseudo-gospels and the four that have survived intact.
Yeah.
All right, last one, external test. What's going on there?
Well, here you're doing what Gary Habermas is probably the master of. Can we find anything outside of them that sort of corroborates, a lawyer would say, corroborates what we find within them? Mm-hmm. And again, your author is Gary Habermas. Evidence of Jesus outside the Gospels or things like that. And it's not as if you've got to have that, but it helps.
Yeah.
It helps to know. One of the reasons that one ought not to expect too much of this, because in the world of that day, Jerusalem and the environs were sort of the boonies, to think of it. Pontius Pilate, when he was awarded Tetrarch of Galilee, probably went home and drank himself into a stupor. Where are you sending me? This is the backwoods compared to the Roman Empire we know. This is not a Cosmopolis.
That's funny. One of the things I remember about this, and I'll say sometimes, is that some of the greatest external evidence is the lack of evidence refuting the resurrection from the time. Why is that? Well, within a very short period of time, the resurrection of Christ becomes not just a personal life-saving event to the people that believe it, but it actually becomes a world-changing event fairly quickly. And it would seem that as the disciples are sort of participating in this world-changing event and saying, I believe these things based on these witnesses, like Paul, who, you know, over 501 times saw him alive, that it would make sense if this was a total hoax and that that there would have certainly been people who knew it was a hoax would have written as well.
Sure, there was every incentive in the world to expose it.
And there's an astonishing lack of that, you know, those refutations to the resurrection message. Okay, we're going to take our commercial break, and then we'll be back and we'll discuss the higher critics.
Thank you.
Hey, welcome back from our break. Today, instead of talking about a book like we usually do, we're going to talk about a unique opportunity and experience that some listeners may want to capitalize on or may want to tell a student in their life to capitalize on, and that is the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, which happens annually in Strasbourg, France. And that's run by Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. And Dr. Keith is going to talk about that a little bit. I have a flyer for it that I'm going to put in the show notes, a little picture there, and a link to the website. But Dr. Keith attended it, and so he'll be able to tell you all about it. And I think the other two gentlemen at the table, Dr. Rosemont and Dr. Francisco, have both taught at it at various times as well. So.
Yeah, it's usually a two-week event. I don't want to mess this up. A two-week event happens every year. I think it's been going on since 1996 or 7. I went in 1997, and I wasn't sure if it was the first year or the second year. I knew it was early. I'm looking at the flyer here, and 1517 Legacy Project that hosts the Thinking Fellows is also considered a patron of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. So we support this endeavor quite a bit. Dr. Rosenblatt and Dr. Francisco, I think, are considered faculty of this as they teach there somewhat frequently. And what it is it's intensive, what I remember. It's intensive. You get 2 weeks where Monday through Friday, for the most part, you're in class the entire day, and world-class faculty members from everywhere who are authorities in apologetics or evangelism. I don't think there's as much focus on human rights as there used to be.
Yeah, it used to be a separate thing, and the university there oversaw that.
Right. Dr. Kennedy used to do quite a bit, I think he still does.
Yeah, I think under Trinity's banners, he's still there. I saw him last summer.
I would highly, if you're listening to this and you're a student or you're just an educated layperson who is involved in apologetics and you need a little bit more, what we're giving you is sort of the surface level. This would definitely be more training for you. This year, this coming year, 2017, it'll be July 4th through 15th.
And it's worth mentioning it fills early.
Yeah, it does. A year ago, it filled very early. I think it's still filling early. It's in Strasbourg, France. It really can't beat that as far as a location, although it can be warm.
Was.
Yep. Yeah, it can be warm.
Not always, but.
But just gorgeous. The Strasbourg Cathedral is worth the trip alone, let alone the apologetics instruction that you'll get.
The strength of it is, one, that it's going to be evidentialism through and through. Two, it's going to be intensive, as you mentioned. And three, with Dr. Montgomery and Craig Parton there running the show every year and actively lecturing, you're not going to get better. You just aren't going to get better. There'll be others like me and Dr. Horton and others, but to go there just because you'll get to study this under Dr. Montgomery and Craig Parton is justification enough.
Right. You have anything to say, Adam? You taught there, right?
Yeah. The evenings are nice, too. Yeah, I mean, it's always a classy evening at a restaurant, or sometimes there's a gathering at Dr. Montgomery's house.
Dr. Montgomery takes you on a tour of the Alsace, which is quite memorable.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, one of the great Renaissance libraries located there, and walks you through that.
Yeah. Wow,
it's incredible. The weekend, it's 2 weeks. The weekend in between, a lot of people go to Paris, and if you've never been there, it's worth going to see. Why is the museum's name escaping me?
The Louvre.
Thank you. Yeah.
I went to Heidelberg on my weekend. Took the train up to Heidelberg.
Yeah. Well, I went to the Louvre.
So, yeah. So, if you're interested, the flyer will be on our show notes. Just as a warning, I guess I'll say, it's kind of old school.
Yeah, it is.
You can't really go on the website and register for the thing. You have to fill out a piece of paper and send in a check. So, for many of our listeners, that may be great. For some of them, that may be like, what are you talking about? But just as a word of warning, that's how it works. It fills up quickly. So if you're interested in going, I'd say send your check in as soon as you can.
Yeah, I don't even have a checkbook. I have to go to the bank and get one printed off. I have, no need for checks in my...
Yeah.
normal life.
I think it's one more thing worth stating. I think if you're a student too, and you need, you'd like to get credit for it, academic credit for it, that is possible through Concordia University, Wisconsin.
Yeah, I believe it's 3 academic units that they offer.
It's just a matter of inquiring and figuring out what you need to do, what paperwork you need
and
to
fill
out.
In the past, there were scholarships for those who registered early.
There still are.
I think there are as well, yeah.
Yeah, that's listed too at the bottom under the cost. And actually, the cost for the 2 weeks is quite
reasonable.
Yeah, it's quite reasonable. And this is a great time to travel to Europe. The euro is down. So your match to the dollar is closer to 1-to-1.
Yeah, when we were just in Germany, it was actually unbelievable how close it was. Yeah.
And it's actually, flights are fairly cheap right now, too, compared to just even a year ago. So,
yeah, this says that they provide 10 scholarships of $1,000 to students in need during the 2017 one, and an additional $1,500 scholarship for a science educator or student majoring in a science area. And Dr. Rosenblatt's talked about that before, how we need more.
Well, this is the way to the scientist, because you're talking about things that are in principle disprovable. In other words, you're building a case from facts, and that's a long ways from the way other people do it. This is made for lawyers and people in the hard sciences. It was the first time the door was open to me, anyway, studying under Dr. Montgomery, was him saying to me after class, am I right? You did 3 out of 4 years in physics, chemistry, math, bio? And I said, yeah, that's correct. He said, bring every bit of it with you. You'll use every bit of it. I had never heard a Lutheran say such a thing, ever.
Great.
Yep. Check out the show notes. You'll be able to get all that. Even if you can't make it, again, I'd say try to pass it along to a student who you know might be interested in this and need it.
The other thing I'd say, in addition to this, I try to tell pastors this as often as I can. Even if you're LCMS Lutheran and there was nothing at seminary to help, except when Dr. Francisco was at Fort Wayne, there's nothing. Still, you can purchase the audio of Dr. Montgomery's series, Sensible Christianity, put it in your church library, and let people get at it.
Yeah. I've been suggesting that to students around Concordia Irvine's campus, even, because it's not that much for what would even be like a class's worth of instruction at the university if they don't have room for apologetics or if it's not required in their major.
Yeah, Dr. Montgomery did this in city after city after city after city years ago, and it's designed for the layman, not for the clergy. If the clergy want to attend, great, but it's not designed for them. It's designed for the person who says, I need to know more about all of this stuff because of conversations I'm having. Mm-hmm.
All right. Dr. Keith, you ready to hop back into our topic?
Yes, I am. I would like for, and I'll jump in when I can, but I'd like for Rod and Adam to help us with this idea of higher criticism and maybe even do a little compare and contrast to lower criticism or textual criticism. Yeah. As I want the listener to understand that, you know, there is sort of a legitimate critical methodology that can be applied to the text. In other words, in a way of establishing the authenticity and the authority of
the text. Yeah, what we were just talking about.
Right, and that just because they hear sort of a critical methodology that they don't wince in fear and know that there's a difference between higher criticism and, you know, legitimate textual apparatus.
Yeah. It's important that everybody know that this particular method was tried in other fields, and it was dumped. It was done in Shakespeare studies. It was done with regard to the Odyssey and other. And finally, what they found was that the critics were finding as many different authors to a claimed book as you could conceive.
Right, and if a listener wants to get sort of an in to the non-biblical
practice
or even the debate that goes on. There was a fairly classic debate between Cambridge University and Oxford University on utilization of a critical methodologies when it came to literature. And C.S. Lewis wrote a response called An Experiment in Criticism.
Yes.
And he doesn't really deal with the biblical texts in it at all. He sort of just deals with this idea of how how much sort of critical apparatus can we apply to a text, and how much of when we get into higher criticism are we just doing conjecture at
yes.
that point?
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
So it's very important to know that those in other fields tried it and junked it. That's very important to know. The only field still using it is the field of theology. It's alone still using it. Now, what does this have to do with? It has to do with re-examining the question of who wrote a particular book, re-examining questions of dating. It's very easy to write prophecy if you're writing after the prophecy has been fulfilled, and that sort of thing. The one that Dr. Montgomery used years ago was trust in computer analysis of sources. Two fellows named McGregor and Morton decided to do a computer analysis of the Pauline writings. They decided if there was anything in the New Testament genuinely from Paul, it was Romans and Galatians. So they fed into the computer textual patterns from Romans and Galatians and then compared that to the other claimed writings of Paul and came to the conclusion that Paul only wrote Romans and Galatians. Then two hotshot grad students at Harvard took McGregor and Morton's book and did the same thing with
their
it.
Book.
Took the pattern from the first two chapters yeah. as the definitive authored by McGregor and Morton and compared the other chapters to the book and came to the conclusion that there were 12 authors to their book. There's something wrong going right. on here.
Lewis does something similar in experiment to an experiment in criticism, but he does it to his own work.
Well, you know, Lewis, in that essay on faulting the Bible critics, or I think that was a Christianity Today title for it. In the original, it wasn't titled that. But what he talks about is his own writings.
Yeah.
And what he found was, in the critique of his own writings, that the critics were almost wrong every single time. One critic would write, this is typical Lewis and written fluently and easily, and he said, that was the part that I was dying and rewrote 12 times.
Right.
And the ones where they said, this is probably from other sources other than Lewis, he said, those were the ones that I actually wrote very... He said, you've got to be trying to be wrong 100% of the time, but they achieved it. And in our own common culture, in right. the 20th century, English speaking, he said they managed to get everything wrong.
Right. There's some real faulty presuppositions to even attempting this. I mean,
yeah.
you automatically are presupposing that somebody doesn't write when they're in different moods, that
yep.
they're always writing when they're in the same mood.
Yep. Dr. Montgomery's illustration is, I hope your term papers don't read the same as your love letters.
Right. Right. Their age, you know, and whether or not they become a more experienced writer as
yep.
time goes by, that their age doesn't change, their maturity doesn't change. I mean, just so many, there's so many what ifs that the
sure.
that the theologian could answer back to this. Well, what if he was mad at the church in Galatia,
yeah,
you know, and it changed his style. Or what if he was?
Yeah, every other one has the standard greeting that you have for a letter of that century, except for Galatians, which
right.
starts out, "You idiots!"
Right,
not literally, but close.
Right.
I remember walking through when I was in college. I was walking through a cafeteria line, and the guy across from me was a Navy vet, and he mumbled something about, "I wish Peter'd never met the Lord." It was an odd comment, and I said, Daryl, what do you mean by that? He said, you try reading his Greek. He said, he uses words nobody else
right.
uses, and he does it over and over and over and over again. His vocabulary is nothing like any other New Testament writer. I have to live in my helps trying to read Peter.
Mm.
Well, there's that sort of thing. That doesn't fault the text, but it is worth noticing.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about presuppositions is just awful. For instance, and we've dealt with this a little bit before, you start out as an historian saying we can't allow any miracle reports.
Right. I just did an article on that based on
yeah.
Montgomery's work. Yeah.
Right. Heavenly days, if you're using real empirical method, you are not going to say what your results can't be. or what is not allowed. Now, that opens the field pretty widely to some pretty strange things, but it's the way it goes in empirical method. You know, somebody's going to talk about the Loch Ness Monster or the Yeti or...
Well, it's why there's Bigfoot hunters on History Channel.
Right, right. So empirical method, if it really is, you can't start with that before you begin examining the material.
Right.
The other one is, if you redate things, prophecy goes out the window. Prophecy's easy to write if it's already occurred, as I said earlier.
Right.
It wasn't really prophecy at all. You're writing having it already having happened.
But if you can say that, you know, the Gospels were written, you know, post 70 AD, it's pretty easy to explain Christ's prophecy that the
right.
that the every stone in the temple will be overturned.
Right? Yeah.
That type of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there are reasons that secular scholars have given up on this method. Now, if you're going to seminary, you've got to think about this. You do not want to pay real dollars to any seminary in the U.S. or anywhere else where you're paying money to have somebody use this method to undercut your confidence in the text. Now, there are very few seminaries in the United States worth attending where you won't have this done to you. Ask around, talk with others. You need never to give a dollar to a seminary that you're going to pay those guys to do that to you.
So, when we then talk about lower criticism, we're not talking about this, right?
No, it's the establishing of what did the original text say.
Okay.
They're wordsmiths. They work with, if you've ever seen a Greek New Testament, what's at the bottom of the page, the apparatus that links to particular manuscripts. It looks like a miniature bird walked through ink and walked through the bottom of the page. Yeah. That apparatus tells what reading comes from where,
right,
and so forth. But that's not the same as saying, I'm standing over the text and I can see what you can't.
Right.
I can see different authors. If you've ever had to endure an Old Testament class and had to endure JEDP theory of Graf, Kuhnen, and Wellhausen, the multiple sources in the Pentateuch, because it can't have been Moses. And you say, why can't it have been Moses? Well, it includes the story of his death. He couldn't have written the story of his heavenly days. But there's a supreme confidence in being able to see an author shift. It's the same as the McGregor and Morton book. Don't pay people money to learn that stuff and take notes on it and be tested on it.
Yeah. Within textual criticism or lower criticism, I mean, it's the same as what you would just do as a historian studying any
right
field. For instance, if you're in Reformation history,
yep,
I studied Melanchthon. Melanchthon's primary works, the critical edition of Melanchthon's primary works, are still the Corpus Reformatorum. Mm-hmm. At the bottom of that, if I'm studying, say, the 1535 Loci, which I was, you find that in the CR. And you'll look, and there's an introduction with all sorts of critical analysis of the various texts as it was published, where it was published, how many.
And especially Melanchthon, because he was a fiddler.
Right, who the publisher was, if there's any variance in the different editions,
yep,
of the text.
Yep.
And what you're just attempting to do is, because you're trying to write something that, I guess, means something or adds to the base of knowledge on Melanchthon, you're trying to find which text should I use.
Yes.
Right? To do my study.
Yep.
And that's essentially what you're saying here. Yep. And that's common within just the practice of doing history.
Yeah, the establishment of the definitive text and why.
Have anything to add there, Adam?
Not so much, except when you compare like higher criticism to text criticism or lower criticism, the difference is quite amazing on just how presumptuous higher criticism
absolutely.
Is.
Absolutely.
And it's no coincidence that method, if you will, and the assumptions that go along with it emerge in the day where the prevailing worldview, if you will, was this philosophical naturalism.
Sure.
Where it's assumed that you've got to account for everything by appealing to natural causes. So you get a guy like David Hume, who will influence biblical studies tremendously through the ages, even presently. You see his influence in even Bart Ehrman, but who will assume from the get-go, before even looking at the evidence, that miracles don't happen.
Sure.
Dead people don't rise.
Sure.
And then they take that assumption about the way the world works and impose it upon the text. And I mean, that I'm sure in the 18th century when Hume got that sort of approach rolling, it didn't seem so presumptuous. In our day and age, post-Einstein, if you will, where you can't assume anything about nature or the world, the objective world, and to actually look at it, it's the assumptions behind it are just staggering.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. If the listeners are more interested in sort of these assumptions that go into historical accounts, right, by sort of Humean, in the Humean approach here, they should really go over, and I'm sure Caleb will post in the show notes, the article that I just did, Can Historical Accounts of Miracles Be Trusted?
Yes.
At 1517. And if that interests them, it's only 1,000 words. It's very easy to get at, very easy to digest. If that interests them, they can read the longer version that is Dr. Montgomery's A Critique of Certain Uncritical Assumptions in Modern Historiography. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, and there are definitive books on the Achilles heels in the method. One's out of Concordia on the failure of the historical critical method. One we used to have amongst the living was Uta Linnemann.
Yes.
And she did some marvelous work. She was Boltmann's top grad student. If you don't recognize the name Boltmann, that's okay. But she was, you know, doing these ghostwritten things for him, and at the same time drinking a fifth of whiskey a day just to keep anesthetized to be able to do it. Then she was roundly and soundly converted.
That's why we all put on weight during our PhD program.
And became his nightmare because she had been in the inner sanctum of who was doing what and how and exposed it all. Uta Linnemann.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there are books like this that will show you the intellectual wantingness of the whole method and why in detail.
It's, you know, Dr. Montgomery sums this up really nicely in many things that he wrote, but what I have always taken away from it is that in order to participate in the higher critical method, you actually have to be convinced of the fact that your general knowledge is more complete than any knowledge you can have of a particular instance.
Yeah.
In other words, my general knowledge of my wife's behavior will always trump what she actually did or didn't do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and in the lab, that's insanity.
Right, and that's kind of what it is. But not to, like, to trot this example out farther, but that's what, you know, drives people crazy in their marriages even, is the fact that somebody gets mad at them for what they didn't do because they know, I know how you're going to act in that. And it's sort of doing,
I don't know what you're talking about.
I knew what you would have said, so I didn't ask you, right? And it's that same type of just idiotic assumption that is applied then within the academic process of trying to determine whether a text is authored by a person or things in the text could have happened or couldn't have happened. It's just bad scholarship.
Yep. I remember Dr. Montgomery saying years ago when I was in class with him, he said, don't go after higher criticism because its results are impious. Go after it because it's crappy scholarship.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's another book, apart from Linnemann's work, is The End of the Historical Critical Method.
That's it.
Gerhard Meyer.
That's from Concordia.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wittgenstock now publishes it.
But okay.
It's a slim book.
Yep.
A little detailed, or, you know, a lot of scholarly jargon, but certainly worth reading if you're so inclined, because it demonstrates, you know, in a comprehensive, rigorous way, just how filled with philosophical assumptions or ideology that method, how full it was.
And it's difficult. You're swimming against the stream because 90% of the seminaries, what happens is, I remember this from Dr. Montgomery too, when you lose your confidence in the total reliability of Scripture, something comes to fill the vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And what came to fill the vacuum was their method. You divinize your method
right.
When you've lost confidence in the text.
Right, that's problematic at best.
Yeah. You see it. You still see the effects of higher criticism today. I mean, it's a fairly common assumption that Mark was the first gospel written, and John the last gospel. And the reason why, because the second century church fathers believed Matthew was the first one
that
was written. And the higher critics said, well, it makes sense that Mark would be, because you have the Christology there is not as developed as John. You know, they assume the Son of Man passages didn't refer to Daniel 7, but just it's Jesus calling himself a man, right?
Oh!
But so they would order the Gospels that way and say, so that means Matthew and Luke borrowed from Mark. All that might be true, who knows, but it's all conjecture.
Yeah, and then based on their assumptive knowledge of things that happened 2,000 years ago that they were not there to witness.
And you've heard of the Q?
Yes.
This source that Mark used in Matthew and Luke, and you're like, where is it?
Yeah.
Right. It doesn't exist.
Fortress Press has a concordance to Q.
Without Q.
Yeah. you can buy a concordance to Q.
That is a commentary on Fortress Press.
Oh,
imagine being able to get away with that in any other field.
Yep,
whether it's history or science, where
you
go and defend your thesis before your dissertation committee, or you're publishing a book through Oxford University Press, and they say, "Well, you've got all these assertions about X, Y, and Z. Where are your sources?" Well, there is a source. I just don't have it.
I actually believe that George Washington composed something like our Constitution prior to our Constitution. Our Constitution's based on that. Well, do you have that document? No, but it makes sense given all Y, and Z. And so much of it makes sense that I published a concordance of what it would be if I actually had it and I knew it actually
exactly. Now, the other thing to know here is that they are. In our little world of theology, they are the kingpins. The critics are the kingpins at almost every seminary. It's easy to do this when you're the kingpins.
Mm. Mm.
It's very important that you find some place to go to seminary where they're not the kingpins.
I had a friend, and then we have to end because it's time, right?
It is definitely time.
I had a friend who would often say to me that he believes that they are the kingpins because, and this is assumption, and I just think it's interesting to ponder, because in a sense it gets them the seat back at the academic table that's kind of pulled away a little bit if you're seen as fundamentalist or you're seen as...
That makes sense.
You know, Bible-believing. Mm-hmm. And what a shame. What if you're Bible-believing because the scholarship points to the direction that you ought to be?
Yep.
And then you think the only way back to your table is to be disingenuous with what the scholarship actually shows to be the case.
Yep.
So I don't know if that's true, but I always thought it was interesting when he'd say that.
Yeah. It psychologically makes sense. But it is worth noting,
right?
Because, for instance, I never considered going to do my doctorate in Germany. Never. Why? Because in today's German theological faculties, anybody who's looking at the New Testament as somewhat dependable material, the only category they've got for it is Pietismus. I remember when Dr. Horton was having dinner with, reported having dinner with Jürgen Moltmann, and he said to him over dinner, "Dr. Moltmann, you're obviously an Hegelian. Were an American student to come and study under you in Germany and didn't embrace your Hegelianism, could he get the degree?" Moltmann's answer, of course not.
Of course. Yeah, maybe we'll talk about this on the next show. We have to end up. But as you're sitting here talking about all the Humean presuppositions, I'm sitting here thinking, every time I come across higher criticism, I'm thinking Hegel. I'm thinking a philosophy that believes it can predict the ins and outs of a universe deductively and doesn't really necessarily feel the need to connect their deductive propositions to things that they actually view in the real world.
Sure, and along that same line, kind of obliquely, the number of guys in our field who have done hard work in the hard sciences is very few. When I was at a liberal Lutheran seminary, we had a student body entering of 70 guys, and there were two of us who were pre-med. Mm. All the rest were in the soft sciences, 68 of them. And two of us were in the hard science and sciences and asked questions that the others didn't even know why we were asking.
Right. All right, we need to wrap up.
So, all right.
Thanks for joining us. We'll actually pick this conversation up for us in just a few minutes, but for you, you have to wait a week.
Yep. All right. See you next week.